100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and if you're listening on Monday, good morning. I hope Monday is as happy a day as this. It's a beautiful day out. Blue sky, a little bit of wind, not bad.
Great. Perfect way to close out January.
A little
in
January
Iowa.
Thaw, I think.
Yeah. And, so Writers' Voices is broadcast live Fridays 1 to 2 p.m., rebroadcast Monday morning 8 to 9 p.m., and if you miss it, miss part of it, want to share the show, check out writersvoices.com for the podcast about a week or so after we are on the air. Okay, and you can check out past shows there. I'm slowly getting all the past shows up, so I think we have over 200 available now.
Oh, my gosh.
And a couple hundred more coming soon.
How many years have we been doing this?
We've been doing this for 9 years, Mom.
9 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what do we have in store today?
Well, today we have a really interesting book. It's called 52 Small Changes for the Mind. And it's written by Brett Blumenthal. And she is a best-selling author of several books, including A Whole New You, 6 Steps to Ignite Change for Your Best Life in 2012, and 52 Small Changes, 1 Year to a Happier, Healthier You. And also, Get Real and Stop Dieting. I like that one. She's the founder of SheerBalance.com and speaks globally on topics of change and well-being. Brett has been featured on popular websites such as the Huffington Post and in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. She has appeared on NBC, Fox, and CBS. She's had more than 20 years of experience in wellness and almost 10 years of experience as a management consulting, and she received her MBA and bachelor's degrees from Cornell University. She is certified by WellCOA, Wellness Council of America, and AFAA, the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America. So she's got a lot of credentials there. And it's easy to read because it's in small increments, and that's what I like that.
52 Small Changes for the Mind. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Brett.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So tell us how this book came to be.
Well, as you read, or as you told your listeners, I should say, I originally wrote 52 Small Changes, 1 Year to a Happier, Healthier You, and it was a holistic approach. It dealt with fitness and nutrition and mental well-being and even green living, personal, you know, how you're basically keeping your home and your products clean. And it did so well, and people really grasped on to the concept of 52 Small Changes as a concept and really loved it and wanted more. And so when I polled my readers, they really wanted more around mental well-being. Mm. So that's sort of how this book in particular came to be. And the reason I think that a lot of people were sort of wanting more of this is because I think a lot of people know if they're healthy from a physical perspective. You know, they know if they're eating right, they know if they're, you know, taking time to exercise. But when it comes to your mental well-being, I think it's a little less tangible. And so people really grapple with what is it that can make me happier, more productive, have less stress, and even be maybe better at memory. So that's sort of what this book tackles.
And how did you come up with the structure of the 52 small changes, and why do you think that's important?
Well, I think when we think about New Year's resolutions, we always make a big, lofty resolution at the beginning of a year in the hopes that this year is going to be different. And this is, you know, we're going to aim to make some sort of big change, and we have big goals for the full year. And, you know, within a few weeks, often, a lot of people tend to, you know, either give up or move on or forget about it. And so a year goes by, and then they realize that they didn't really necessarily fulfill their, you know, hope to make these changes. And so it dawned on me, one, there's something to the idea of a year, you know, that we have this, maybe it's a human thing, clearly, but we have this need for giving ourselves a year of time to make changes often, usually because of the new year. But, you know, in my experience, both professionally and personally, I found that a lot of people did not accept change, especially big, overwhelming change, very easily. And so the way to solve that was to sort of take a big change and break it up into smaller changes. Being happier is a big change, but what does that really entail? Or, you know, being more productive is a big change potentially, but what do you do to get there? And so as a result, sort of the structure of giving yourself a year, but taking it in, you know, week by week versus one big year at a time, is a much more manageable and approachable way of trying to make a change.
Because we have a lot of distractions in today's world that we didn't have even 10 years ago, you know, all the things.
And you do address some of those in the book, don't you?
Yeah. On week 27.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about in week, you know, in week 12, for instance, I talk about reading for pleasure. And as you said, things have changed in the last few decades. I mean, 30 years ago or more, people read for the most, you know, mm-hmm. entertainment. That was mm-hmm. the most common form of entertainment for people. They were reading. Today, we have so many other forms of entertainment, whether it be computer games or TV or movies or even just browsing the internet can be entertaining. So, you know, we're not reading as much as we used to, and when we do read, often it is very geared towards a have to more than a want to. And this is not to say, I mean, clearly we're talking to people probably today who read more than the common average person, but, you know, that being said, there's room for improvement in that area for a lot of us, and myself included. And so taking some time to really focus on something that's pleasurable as opposed to work-related or a have-to for reading gives our mind a lot of benefits. I mean, we can, first of all, when we think about television, reading is an active process engaging several parts of the brain, while watching television doesn't do that. It also helps you learn new things, and it helps with neuroplasticity. And, of course, if you're reading something that's, you know, of interest and something that's entertaining value, it can make you happier, and it helps our imaginations grow. So small changes like that, you know, trying to sort of take away your everyday entertainment of technology and allowing yourself to get back to basics can have a really big impact.
Well, you say in that chapter that reading books or literature because you think you should will not be pleasurable. And if you start a book and find your mind wandering or interest lacking for several days, then abandon that and go to something else. I think that's good. It's a good
advice. And if you're looking,
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, if you're looking for ideas of books to read, of course, there's lots of bestseller lists and so forth. But we had a guest on a couple years ago, Kevin Smokler, who wrote 50 practical classics, why you should go back and you know, books that you may have read in high school or maybe you didn't, always thought you should, and he talks about each one. So that's a good place to start to see, okay, what would really intrigue you to check that out?
I mean, I'm a big proponent of not reading something you're not enjoying.
Right. I agree, totally.
If you pick up a book thinking you're going to enjoy it and you don't, then, you know, of course, give it a little, you know, chapter or two, but if you can tell it's not going to entertain you or fulfill you in some form or fashion, then just move on and find another one.
There's plenty of books out there.
It always surprises me how many people don't read for pleasure ever.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it's time. I mean, if you have kids, you know, a lot of your time is geared towards trying to make sure they're okay. And of course, when you, if you're also working and have kids, then you have even less time. So, you know, time becomes a bit of an issue. But, you know, if you think about the time that maybe you're putting towards television, for instance, there's no reason why you can say, instead of watching 2 hours of television tonight, I'm only going to watch an hour and a half and back it off and then take that other half an hour and read instead. And actually, when you think about reading versus television, it's better for your sleep, which is actually another weak change that
yes,
I talk about,
absolutely.
How important sleep is and things you can do to ensure you're getting good quality sleep. And one of the things is to turn off technology at least an hour before bedtime, because your brain processes information from screens in a sort of a way that kind of stimulates the brain in a way that doesn't allow you to relax so you mm-hmm. can go to sleep more easily. While reading, it sometimes puts you to sleep.
Yeah,
true.
You know, taking that half an hour of time out of your, you know, TV watching or even an hour and putting it towards reading could be an easy way of finding the time.
You know, I know a lot of people have TVs in their bedroom. I never have. I've never done that.
No, me neither.
Of course, I do have a tablet that can go anywhere.
Yeah, there you go.
But, you know, you talk about kids, having kids and limiting the time being limited. One thing I might suggest is that even with fairly small children, there are books that you can read aloud that are that would be interesting to you and to the kids. They may not sit still for it, but like with my grandkids, sometimes when I would read aloud a book that was a little over their, you know, a little beyond, it wasn't a picture book. It was maybe geared to an older reader, but they would play and wander around and still listen and still enjoy it too.
Right.
The Wizard of Oz.
Probably
books.
Helping them.
Yeah.
Like a way that their brains are benefiting as well, you know.
Right. And improving their vocabulary. And, one of them, I remember the whole Wizard of Oz series that I read aloud to my kids when they were little. And they, you know, it was far beyond what they would have read to themselves, or even, you know, maybe too advanced in some sense, but they still enjoyed it. Yeah. Well, what are...
Remember the movie Princess Bride?
Yes.
The grandfather reads Princess Bride to, isn't it Freddie Savage?
Oh,
and I think
yeah.
In that movie, which is crazy because he's like on this television show today as a full-grown adult in it. it's interesting because that was probably, if you think about it, a book that, there were no pictures, but the movie, you know, the movie was sort of, in a sense, probably his way of imagining how the book played out, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is something really beautiful to reading literature to children that helps them with creativity, because reading does inspire creativity, because you have to visualize all that's happening in the book. So that is also another benefit that I talk about with reading.
Now, Brett, tell us a little bit about how you came to be, to be an expert in wellness. Where did you start?
Well, it's a long story, but a very simple story. I was a kid in high school that didn't really like gym, because I was picked last always for every team. And
me too.
So although I wasn't an overweight child or, you know, really unfit from the basic perspective, I just shied away from sports and played only sports that I would play by myself, like tennis versus like team sports, for good reason. And so when I got to college, you know, a couple of different events inspired me to take charge of this perception that I was like this unathletic person and change that perception both for myself as well as from the outside. And so I started taking some aerobics classes and found that I really loved them, and then decided I was going to become an instructor. And then I started teaching, and I loved, loved, loved it. And I realized quickly that the benefits I was seeing from being a somewhat fitter person, if you will, went way beyond what was very superficial, that the benefits that I was looking for from a superficial perspective. I started noticing that I was less stressed. I was interested in eating healthier. I was able to concentrate more. And so there clearly were benefits that went way beyond what, as a kid, you know, I was 17 when I went to school, I didn't really understand the full scope of the benefits of exercise. So I started really exploring, I became passionate about wellness, and so I taught throughout college, I taught throughout my professional career, taught throughout business school, and then eventually I got burned out and I stopped. But the wellness aspect really stayed with me, and when I went to business school, I focused on spa and wellness management because I just was so interested in the industry. And I sort of, after graduating business school, carved a very unique path in doing wellness strategy for an architecture firm because I actually am an architect.
Wow.
Very, very curious path. I know, I'm all over. But long story short, when I did leave that position, I had been on the side writing about wellness for some time, and I decided that I was going to take it and make it a career. And so that's kind of how it all transpired. Mm. It all started with being picked last in gym class.
Well, there's so many different things you have in here. I mean, well, first, put pen to paper. Let the music play. Mm-hmm. Show your pearly whites. I love that one. And, you know, just on and on. So that it's, if one thing doesn't appeal to you, then try the next chapter because it might very well.
So show your pearly whites.
Exactly right.
I'm guessing that's about smiling. Is that what that is?
It's very true. And it may sound very trite, but there are studies that show that smiling is beneficial. Even when you're not necessarily wanting to smile, sometimes even a fake smile can have benefits that you would never suspect.
Well, smiling is catching. That's true.
They show that a simple smile can be beneficial from a stress perspective. If you start a smile and somebody sees that smile, usually they smile back and our heart rate goes down and it reduces our stress levels. Mm-hmm. And we feel a sense of fulfillment and happiness from eliciting a smile from somebody else. So it's really interesting. I mean, I know when I fake smile and it looks horrible. So even when you don't feel like smiling, you have to work on finding a natural way of doing it, even if you're not feeling like it, I guess.
Well, I've also found that even if there's nobody looking, for example, when you're talking on the phone, if you smile when you're talking on the phone, that carries through the phone lines, and you can elicit a better response.
Absolutely.
From the person on
the other
end.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Somehow your voice, you know, changes.
Yeah.
And, well, just like a yawn is catching, a smile is also catching.
Now, we also talking about time.
Facial feedback.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Brett.
There's something called a facial feedback response theory that actually suggests that the act of smiling makes us feel better and can improve our mood even when you have to force it. And so that's, I think, sort of what you're talking about. It's like you can feel a sense of relaxation. And actually, if you're against Botox, this is really, I think, interesting. I'm at the age where I'm like, oh, here we go. I can see why people do it. I've always been, I'm not going to be that person, But as you get older, you start to realize, well, I can understand why people become that person. And, you know, if you smile, you cannot frown and smile at the same time. And so if you are starting to see lines in that forehead, try to smile more because you will stop causing those wrinkles.
No more frown lines. You know, my daughter, we're here in Iowa, and so I don't think Botox is a real big thing around here. But my daughter was living in L.A., and she was suggesting that it was time for me to consider Botox. I'm like, what are you talking about?
What?
Oh. Well, it's funny. My mom, who is an all-natural beauty, like, she will never do anything. She said to me the other day, I think I might want a facelift. And I said, Mom, you are 70-something. How can you possibly want that at this point? You're beautiful. Don't do it.
No.
I don't think she ever would. But it was like, you know, I guess it's sometimes you look at yourself and you're just like, yeah.
Well, I think every woman
in the bottle
that my daughter knows out there who's older than her does those things. It's just so common. In that particular subculture, but here it's not as common here. So, and here is Fairfield, Iowa, and you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on KRUU 100.1 FM. And our guest today is Brett Blumenthal, author of 52 Small Changes for the Mind, Improve Memory, Minimize Stress, Increase Productivity, and Boost Happiness. So is happiness the overriding goal for these changes?
Well, I think everybody would like to be happier. I mean, I think we'd all be lying if we didn't say we could all use a little bit more happiness in our lives. But it's really meant to be overall mental wellness, not just happiness. And that incorporates memory, stress management, and even the ability to be more productive and focus and concentrate more easily. And so throughout the book, I have different icons, and those icons sort of let you know which of those four categories you're really focusing on with that change. So for instance, if you look at it, funny enough, you mentioned Let the Music Play, which is basically talking about how music is extremely beneficial to the brain in so many ways, and it actually will tap into all areas of the brain. Unlike some of the habits, music has this ability to have to basically touch all different parts of the brain. It releases neurochemicals that directly affect sleep patterns and happiness and reward and pleasure centers. And so as a result, they're all four icons that show what it's entailing. It's going to help improve memory, it's going to help minimize stress, it's going to help increase productivity and boost happiness. While some, like show your pearly whites, are a little bit more specific to happiness and stress versus the other two. And so, you know, throughout the book, you'll know what you're focusing on that week, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, if someone started this from the beginning and implemented all these changes consecutively, by the 52nd week, how much time per day would that be taking? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, none of these are really like time wasters.
No.
I would say that, you know, some people will make these changes more easily than others, and some people might make certain changes more easily than others, while other people might struggle with them. It really depends on who you are and what you're doing, like, currently and what you're struggling with. But, you know, certain things, like smiling, right? We talked about smiling.
Okay, that one doesn't take any time.
Isn't necessarily... going to take any time, right? It's going.
Right.
You have to mentally be aware that you're not smiling and make more of an effort to do so. But that's not going to take a huge amount of time. It's just more of a habit that you're changing. While week one, which is about journaling, is going to take whatever time you feel is required. You know, it's up to you. And a lot of this book, it's really up to you. It's your journey. And although I give you 52 weeks of changes in a specific order, that's not to say that somebody going through this book can't hop around. You know, if they find that week 18 is really appealing and they kind of want to get started with week 18, so be it. You know, if it works for them, that's what matters the most. And by the end of the 52 weeks, just as the book prescribes, if you're doing all these things, you should be more productive, so time should be less of an issue.
Ah, good point. Well, why don't you read a little bit from the introduction so that our listeners can get a real good idea of how the book is structured?
Sure. Okay. I'd be happy to. Small changes work. I know they do because I've seen the results among many of my readers and other individuals who've abandoned the change everything at once approach for one that is geared towards making small changes over time. It makes sense. Small changes are less overwhelming and more realistic, and they give us a sense of accomplishment more quickly. Regardless of the change a person wants to make, three things remain true. Any major change actually requires many smaller changes. Taking an all-or-nothing or extreme approach doesn't work, and small changes that we can manage and master feed our desire to succeed. In my first Small Changes book, 52 Small Changes, 1 Year to a Happier, Healthier You, I prescribe a small change each week for 52 weeks so that by the end of the year, readers are happier and healthier. The approach is holistic and addresses four dimensions of well-being: diet, nutrition, fitness and prevention, mental well-being, and green living. As I conducted research for 52 Small Changes, it became all too clear that I could have easily prescribed countless small changes within each of these categories. When thinking through which topic of change I wanted to address next, I personally found the category of mental well-being, aka mental wellness or mental health, to be especially compelling. For many, maintaining good mental health is a bit elusive compared to maintaining good physical health. Understanding diet, nutrition, or maintaining an exercise regimen is much more straightforward. You're either eating healthy or you aren't. You're either exercising or you're not. Moreover, when we are physically unhealthy, the symptoms are undeniable. We gain weight, we lose energy, we struggle with everyday tasks, and we feel lousy. Mental well-being, on the other hand, has more gray area. For starters, most of us don't look at the whole picture when it comes to our mental well-being. We tend to focus on only one aspect, our happiness. While having good mental health most definitely means feeling happy and fulfilled, it also means that we can manage stress. We have a positive outlook on life. We can focus and concentrate when needed, so we are productive and can remember things easily. Some might even argue that a happy, healthy mind is the most important aspect of our overall health. 52 Small Changes for the Mind uses the approach of making small changes over the course of a year and applies it specifically to improving mental well-being. As with my first book, the changes prescribed are comprehensive, addressing multiple areas instrumental in achieving optimal mental health: stress management, concentration and productivity, memory and anti-aging, and of course, overall happiness and fulfillment. Over the course of the next 52 weeks, I hope you'll find the changes to be fun and relatively easy to implement, and that you'll enjoy the process. The goal, by the end of the year, you should be able to manage stress, be more productive, remember more, ward off disease and aging, and feel happier and more fulfilled.
And you can start this at any time. It doesn't have to be January 1st.
You're listening to Writer's
and
Voices.
And that's so true.
And you're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brett Blumenthal, the author of 52 Small Changes for the Mind, and she just read from that for us.
Forget the Joneses chapter. That's number 7. That's the problem in today's world. We are some of us are so consumed with what somebody else thinks of us or how we compare to somebody else. You know my favorite saying: don't worry about what other people think of you, because they rarely do. Isn't that true? They rarely do. They're consumed with themselves. They're not thinking about you.
So, Brett, when you started working on this book, how did you come up with the 52 unique small changes? And did you start with a longer list and winnow it down, or did you start with a smaller list and build it up?
Well, some of it came out of my research for the first book because, as I said, you know, there were so many changes I could have prescribed, but I couldn't obviously prescribe more than 52 for the book, so some of them came from original research where I realized that there were certain things that could be elaborated on or added to that book that I was able to put into this book. Some of it also came just from my overall research and over time, just in general, but then also finally when speaking to experts and doing, you know, the secondary research that I did for this book and reading different, you know, research papers and studies, that sometimes new ones were keyed off then. And so all of them are based on what research is already out there and puts it into a format that kind of is, as we've talked about, very digestible. And I would say that there were probably a total of 70 when I started, and then I had to pare back to 52. Some of them got sort of melded together, and some mm-hmm. of them went away completely.
And what were some of the criteria that you used in deciding which ones really mattered?
Well, I really am a believer that there should be research done on what I write about, being in a nonfiction, you know, genre. So the pieces that made it into the book are all backed by research and studies that have been done that sort of prove that this change is going to actually be of value. If I could not find significant research or something that really made the case that it was a value, then it didn't make it into the book. So that was one piece. The other was that I wanted it to be easy enough that, some of the changes, some people might argue, are difficult, but as I mentioned, for some people, they won't be difficult. So although generally, you know, I would like to think that everyone finds all these changes easy, the ones that I chose specifically were meant to be smaller than larger. So they were manageable within potentially a week to a month of trying to incorporate them into your lifestyle. And then finally, the third piece of criteria was just that they really were geared towards those four areas that I mentioned, whether it be something to do with memory, something to do with stress, something to do with productivity, or something to do with happiness, or if it was really a good change, then it might even have impact on all four areas. So those were the three major pieces that helped inform which changes made it into the book.
Now, have you incorporated all these changes in your life, or I'm assuming a lot of them you already were doing before you started writing?
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. I, like almost everybody out there, has room for improvement, trust me. I often say to my husband and friends and family, you know, I need to read my own book. I think I need help. And it's funny, all of them are top of mind when I'm writing about them, but, you know, sometimes book publishing goes in a way that it takes a lot longer for the book to actually make it onto the shelves than you'd like, and before you know it, you know, you're now promoting a book that you wrote a year and a half ago. So you have to reread it to really know what's in it. And, you know, I think when I was working on it, all of them were top of mind, and I was probably incorporating them much better, you know, every day than I am today. And so I do think that rereading my own books can be of value.
I bet. Brett, walk us through kind of your writing process a little bit. Do you, for example, do you write at a specific time of day? Do you write for a specific amount of time? Do you have an office? Do you write in coffee shops? You know, what's it like for you as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question because I always look at the people in coffee shops and I just not believe that they're able to actually get work done. But that is not me. That is definitely not me. I'm a very diligent person, and I've been called prolific because when I say I'm going to do something, it gets done. And each of my books has had a very similar process. I would say that as this one was written, this one was the most difficult to write because I had a newborn.
Ah. Oh, my goodness.
It became crucial that I was extremely productive. So generally speaking, my best writing time is in the morning. And so I often will write mostly in the morning after, I would say, 2 o'clock. I can see that my attention span and my productivity start to wane. So I try to do most of the heavier writing in the morning. When it comes to designing and structuring the book, all of my books have always had a very clear structure to them, and I think that goes back to my management consulting days when I had, you know, lots of structure that I was putting in forward, you know, in front of clients. So everything is meant to be user-friendly. I used to write training modules for my clients, so you can imagine I have a very similar approach, which makes it very easy to write the books because, in a sense, the structure almost, you know, gives me an automatic timeline. With 52 small changes, it's very easy to say, well, I need to write this many changes by this amount of time, and then break it up into weeks or days or whatever needs to happen. And then I always allocate, you know, a certain amount of my time period for my deadlines that's geared towards my own editing. I heavily edit my own work. And so I usually have about a week or two cushion in there for that. And then it's really just that easy. I'm not a type of person who can write when I hear music or a lot of noise. So I like to sit in my office and just heads down, you know, get it done. I'm very easily distracted by noise and other things, so the quieter the better.
So, Brett, you say you heavily edit your own work, but do you do that as you write, or do you, you know, put it all down on paper really quickly and then go back and edit?
Well, so my mom was a writer, and I grew up with my papers and whatever that I wrote throughout my entire elementary and high school and junior high school careers, having red lines all over my papers. So she was a great editor, which drove me crazy at the time, but probably made me the writer I am today. So I really can't complain about it. But at the time, as a kid, you don't really feel very very good about that. So I think I learned because of that process where I would write, she would edit, I would rewrite, she would edit. I just learned to really get onto the editing page from the minute I put pen to paper. And I have to hope and I have to believe, and I hope that they're not just, you know, blowing smoke up my tush, but I've always been told that my books are really easy to edit because they're so well edited. And so I do usually two or three edit formats. The first is, as I'm writing, I will go back and like change things as I'm writing them. And then I'll do a second pass once I have a chapter completed. And then I usually will do a third pass after I have a chunk of chapters, you know, written. And then finally, after the whole book is written, I go back and edit again for flow and continuity throughout the whole book. So I would say I probably would enjoy editing as a career because I enjoy it.
Oh, my goodness.
So when you started writing books, you were already publishing articles at that point? Is that true? Or?
Well, I would say, I mean, people would call it blogging, I guess. I never liked calling it blogging because at the time it was very, I didn't think bloggers were taken very seriously. And so I like to call it an online magazine for wellness, but, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was a blog. And I wrote a lot there, and a lot of my posts were syndicated on Yahoo and other media channels that really liked my writing within the health and wellness genres on their sites. So Yahoo had Yahoo Health, and there was Shine. They had a whole Shine. I don't know if you know about Shine, but it's not there anymore. But it was a Yahoo platform for women voices, basically. Mm. Gretchen Rubin got, I think, a good portion of her start, like, online start there too. So she was writing about the Happiness Project at the time. And so, yeah, that was sort of where I started. And when I wasn't working at that firm that I was mentioning earlier, I decided to start looking into ways.
Oh, no, we lost her. Okay, I hope that wasn't the entire phone system that went out. But in the meantime, Mom, why don't you read a little bit from one of these 52 okay. small changes? This is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And we just lost connection with our guest today, Brett Blumenthal. So until we get her back, hopefully that's her.
I bet that's her.
Hi, I'm hoping this is Brett.
That's me.
Okay. I don't know what happened there, but we're glad to have you back.
Where did I lose you? I think it was, I wrote online for some time, and then when I stopped working at the company I mentioned that, I decided I wanted to see if I could make it into a real career, and that's when I started writing books.
And how did you find your publisher?
Oh, so this is also a really interesting story. I did a lot of research with, you know, different writers or authors that I knew of, and I kind of got a feel for the landscape of the industry. And it quickly dawned on me that if I was going to test the market, the test was going to take 2 years, and I just didn't want to wait that long to see if it would come to fruition. And so I actually self-published my first book, and at that time, Amazon Publishing had come out of the woodworks, and their model, if I'm sure you're familiar with how they started, they were, but for your listeners, they really looked towards finding self-published authors who were doing well and using them as their sort of, I guess, their launching group. And at the time, it was great timing, and my book was doing really well, and so they asked me if they could be my publisher. And so at that point, I had marketed the heck out of that book, and I was done, and I said, if you can sell more of it, let's do it. So I was an Amazon published author with the first book after they republished it. And I stayed with them for a couple more books, and then I kind of was curious as to the differences between traditional publishers versus Amazon, because they really, as you know, kind of changed the market and the landscape. And so I really wanted to sort of see what it was like to be on the other side. And so that's when I went to Chronicle. And so I had an agent at that point. And
is this book your first one with Chronicle?
It is, yeah.
It is, okay. And we love Chronicle books. They're they're all
they're fun.
So beautifully made. They
Well, that was one of the reasons I chose them, because I, as an architect, and now actually another aside, I'm a wildlife artist, and
oh my gosh,
very strong. I have a strong, you know, passion for design, and so the thing with Chronicle is that, I mean, they made the design process for the first time so seamless and so beautiful. It was like
a beautiful
not
book,
even a blip on the radar. It was so beautiful. So yeah, I'm a big fan.
So when you were with Amazon, how did that work? Did they,
well, I mean, it works the same. You know, it's just that their market and their marketing is all online versus a traditional publisher, which tends to focus more on the print. And you know, I would say that when you look at sales, generally speaking, Amazon's going to be trying very hard to sell their Kindle versions. Mm-hmm. And while you would go to, if you were to go to a Chronicle or another traditional publisher, they're going to be selling a lot of print. And so you have to just, you know, kind of figure out what part of that market do you want, or which market are you more interested in?
Because I think they made the right choice, because like you said, I may not want to start with the first chapter when I pick up the book. I'm looking through and I think, okay, I need this.
And it's easier to browse a physical book than a Kindle book. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I never really thought about that.
Yeah,
but that's true. It's easier to find what you're looking for by searching on a digital book. If you'd like, where did I read about such and such? It's easier.
Uh-huh.
But to actually get a feel for what the book is like, there's nothing like
to hold the book,
hold it and page through.
Yep. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly a lot of my thoughts around why I didn't go with Amazon the last time, is that I design my books to be very, like, workbooky. And so I have worksheets in the back, I have little quizzes, I have little checklists. And so on a Kindle, I didn't really find that that was coming through the way I wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like there was sort of a, I mean, it's not like they don't have print versions of the book, but they just don't sell them as much as they sell their digital versions.
Well, Brett, I'm curious, you said that when you originally self-published, now that would have been in 2009 or 10?
It was 2009. They republished in 2010.
Okay. So at that point, did you do print on demand or did you do a whole print run?
I did Create Space, which was Amazon's company.
Okay.
And I think that's why they found me so easily.
Right.
I don't know the different platforms anymore, but I was not going to pay a fortune for somebody to publish my book. I knew how to design a book. I knew how to generally lay out a book. I knew that I was a good writer that didn't probably need a lot of copy editing. As a matter of fact, my mom was my editor. And she didn't redline that one as much as she did my papers in high school. Good thing. Maybe I came a long way since high school.
I think
But I didn't really believe that I needed to pay somebody to publish my book. I felt like that was just not what I personally wanted to do. So as a result, Create Space, and there were a couple others, and I'm totally blanking on the different platforms, but you, I'm sure, know them. That Create Space seemed to make the most sense because they had that whole Kindle link.
Right.
At the time, Kindle was becoming a big thing, and it just seemed like an easy way to go because they would have me listed on their site, and it was a very, very, it was a no-brainer to me, so that's why I went with them. And it was print-on-demand, so I didn't really have to spend very much money at all.
And as a self-published writer, how did you market your book? How did you sell enough to get Amazon's attention and so that they would want to publish you?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just amazing. I mean, I'm a huge believer in working your butt off, but I also believe that luck can come into play if you're working your butt off. And I was very lucky in that I was on these other platforms like Yahoo, and I think Divine Caroline was another one, and Gather.com. I mean, there were a whole bunch that I really don't know what they're doing anymore, but they're not performing the way, they're not acting the way they used to act. I don't feel like their presence is as strong, or if they are, I'm not their market anymore. So that might be more of it. But those platforms are really large, and so I had a huge following through those platforms, and those platforms helped me sell books. And, you know, it was that simple. And so once that reach happened, it made it very easy to sell the books.
And as somebody who already was successful with a published book, I would imagine finding an agent wasn't that difficult.
No, I had four agents that I was speaking to, and it was a very difficult decision as to which agent to go with, but, you know, I knew that if I wanted to leave Amazon, or if I wanted to even see if there were other publishers potentially interested. Actually, I need to back up. Mm-hmm. I was contacted by another publisher, and when my last 52 Small Changes came out, and they said, "We'd really like to be your publisher." And I said, "Okay, now I think I need some representation," because at that point, I couldn't really just leave Amazon. It needed to be a formal process, and I couldn't go behind their back. That was definitely not in my DNA. So I knew that I needed representation, and that's when I started the search for an agent. And, yeah, everyone, I think, I don't know what it's like today, but that was back in 2012, middle of 2012, when I started looking for an agent. And I don't know if it's changed, but people were really confused by my sales numbers, because they were digital. And so having an agent sort of walk publishers through the differences was very helpful. Mm. Because they obviously knew the industry way better than I did. So.
Well, that's all very, you know, that's really interesting to hear.
It is.
Yeah, to hear, because you really are, you know, this is a new world of publishing, and you're really a pioneer in a way. Do you want to talk a little bit about talk a little bit about your website? Are you still blogging?
Yeah, I am. So I mentioned the wildlife art thing, and so I have two businesses now, and so it's, you know, a balancing act, of course, but I generally have been blogging, I would say, over the last 3 or 4 months, you know, especially as the book has come out. I also do a lot of writing within different sometimes on media or print media. I've done some writing recently. But I'm a project lover, so the book thing really kind of works for me. And as much as I think blogging, I'm curious. I'm not really sure where blogging stands today anymore. I feel like if you're constantly doing it, and you have a huge following, then, you know, and you love it, then you should keep doing it. I don't find the blogging nearly as gratifying as the writing books. So it's hard for me to focus on both, and so I tend to focus on the books more. I do utilize social media quite a bit. So, you know, that to that point, I don't know where things really are, but I feel like a lot of people will use social media as a way to communicate with their community more than they did maybe a few years ago. And so, in a sense, blogging doesn't necessarily need to be as, I feel like, as important as having these other channels going as well. Mm. So making sure you're connecting with your members through Facebook or, you know, Twitter or Instagram or, you know, whatever your platform of choice is seems to be very helpful.
Well, what are your websites?
Well, the book at 52smallchanges.com does take you to my website, and it takes you to the book page of the website, so people can easily find me there. And then sheerbalance.com, sheer like S-H-E-E-R, balance.com is my original website, and that's a great place to find me. And then facebook.com/sheerbalance is the community that sort of I like to, you know, talk through Facebook all the time there.
And did you say you had another website for your wildlife art?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, actually, if you go to brett-blumenthal.com, you can find everything. But my wildlife art, my website for that is tinytoesdesign.com.
And when do you sleep?
Well, once my son started preschool, it got a little bit easier. but yeah, I do value sleep, so I make sure that I get that.
Well, you know, you said your mother's editing was kind of disconcerting when you were in high school, but just think of all the students who didn't have that advantage of having.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was a pain in the butt when I was a student, but as a full grown adult who is now a mom. You know, I'm probably going to be doing the same thing to my poor son.
Well, I think that's
sure
I think it's fine
for it, but I don't know. He seems to have a lot of interest in letters, so maybe that's a good sign.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Sounds like it. Good.
Well, Brett, do you have? You know, we're getting very close to the end of the hour. Do you have any advice for somebody who wants to become a published author?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, as you have heard, my path has been so non-traditional, it's really hard to give advice, I feel like, that's, like, solid other than my own personal experience. But I would say that if you want to write a book, then you need to write it. I feel like there are a lot of people who want to write a book, and they tell me they want to write a book, and then they never write it. And I don't think you have to write it to get it published. I think you need to have a good portion of it written. I think you have to have a solid understanding but of what you're going to be writing, clearly for a proposal. But I think that doing your research and understanding the industry and understanding what your market looks like and understanding who your target consumer or target reader is really important. And then, you know, deciding the kind of publishing you want to do, whether it be self-publishing. I mean, self-publishing still has a great place for a lot of people, and it works for a lot of people. So there's nothing wrong with it. If it's something that you feel is right for you, then you should do it. And then think about, you know, if you really feel, and if you do want traditional publishing, finding, the way I found my agents was, there were a few different ways. One was word of mouth. One was through Publisher's Lunch. So I did troll Publisher's Lunch quite a bit to see who was getting deals within the different, within my genre specifically. And then when I was vetting the different publisher or different agents that I really was looking at, I vetted them through Publisher's Lunch even more, because it helped me understand who was really getting the deals versus the people who just were talking about getting deals.
So what's Publisher's Lunch?
yeah. What?
I mean, deals take time, and I've learned that. So I can't, you know, it could have just been timing, but I saw who was getting them. And, you know, I think that really finding a way to ensure that you're getting the writing done, like some people need to map out a timeline and a project plan like I do. Some people really can say, ah, I'm going to write 1,000 words today, and that's enough. But just making sure you find a way to make it happen is, I think, the best thing you can do.
Well, that sounds like very good advice.
Yes.
And there's lots of very good advice in 52 Small Changes for the Mind. And in the 30 seconds we have left, what's next? What are you writing next?
Well, I honestly thought this was my last book.
Yeah, right.
And why did you think that?
I thought it was. I mean, I can't divulge anything, but I am talking to someone about co-authoring a book, because I do think at this point in my life, I've written 4 on my own and I'm a little burnt out, but I do have more ideas, and I also think children's books could be in my future too.
Very good.
The art.
Well, well, thank you so much for being with us today, Brett, and look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a delight having a real conversation.
Yeah, well. Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words for
us
today?
Yeah, I do. And I think probably Brett can relate to this, because with her mother, still her editor. In business and in family relationships, remember that the most important thing is trust.
Mm. And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. It looks like he's got a really interesting show coming up. And also, if you know, Bill Clinton's here in town. We may have missed him already, but if you're listening on Friday, you might still be able to catch him at the Sondheim. And we'll see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.